Good evening. I'm Phil Benincasa, the principal of the Olcott School here in Concord, and it is my pleasure to welcome you here this evening and to thank you for coming out for what I know is going to be a rewarding and exciting evening. Tonight's symposium is sponsored by the Concord Public Schools Human Sexuality Community Advisory Council. The council was established by Tom Scott, superintendent of schools, in the summer of 1990 as a forum for community input on sexuality education in Concord's elementary schools. The committee membership consists of parents, teachers, school administrators, and representatives from the health professions and Concord's faith community. It represents a unique collaborative effort among these groups to support parents in their efforts to raise children with healthy sexual attitudes and behaviors in today's complex and oftentimes threatening environment. One of the committee's primary goals is to provide education for parents on the sexual development of children and to enhance understanding of a parent's role in teaching about healthy sexuality and the moral values that support it. It is our hope that sexuality education in the Concord community will be a true partnership among parents, schools, and our faith communities. With that in mind, the committee plans to present a series of symposiums on topics related to human sexuality in order to bring us together to chart a positive course for the future. Let me remind you now of the panel discussion, which will take place in this auditorium tomorrow at 7:30, and we invite you to participate in that. With that, it seems to me that it is altogether fitting and proper that we begin the process of community education with a challenging look at the development of morality in our children. We are extraordinarily fortunate to have with us this evening Dr. Robert Coles of Concord. For the past 30 years, Dr. Coles has brought his enormous intellect and insight, underscored by the highest of literary skills, to bear on the issue of a child's social and emotional development. As a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and MacArthur Fellow, he has worked with children from around the world and from every level of social strata to help all of us better understand their needs as well as their innate strengths. To those of us who work with and care about children, Dr. Cole's writing is like a fine pair of spectacles that bring into sharp focus a child's universal needs, fears, and joys. That which was once blurred becomes etched clearly upon our mind. It was my pleasure to meet Dr. Coles for the first time this evening, although I must say that my first contact with the Coles family was at the Ripley School, where I was principal, when his boys Daniel and Michael were in their early grades almost 20 years ago. At the same time, I had the truly great pleasure of speaking at length and on numerous occasions with Dr. Coles' lovely wife, partner, and colleague, Jane. She was a great source of insight, knowledge, and strength for me in those early days of my career. Knowing what a wonderful woman she is, I had always promised myself that if I found myself in this very position, as I do this evening, I would begin by saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, I am happy to introduce to you Jane Coles' husband, Robert."
Worth coming here just for that introduction, which I will duly bring home. Actually, my wife taught in the 7th and 8th grades here before our first son was born. We're now getting back into the Middle Ages. I was educated as an English major in college. I wrote my thesis on the first two books of William Carlos Williams' long five-volume poem, Patterson. I might have become a high school English teacher here if I hadn't written that, because that was sort of where I was headed when I was in college, if I hadn't written that thesis. I sent it off to him. He was a physician as well as a poet and novelist and short story writer. I sent it off to him and got back on a prescription, a little note from him. "Dear Mr. Coles, I'm now told this little piece of paper is worth hundreds of dollars. I wouldn't sell it to anyone, but anyway, dear Mr. W.C. Williams, M.D., 9 Ridge Road, Rutherford, New Jersey, and his phone number was not a lot of numbers first, but it was R.U.T. dash, and then 4 numbers. And to dear Mr. Coles, thank you very much for your thesis. It was not bad dash for a Harvard student, period. And then one more sentence. If you're ever in the neighborhood, please drop by. Well, a week later, I was in New York calling from the bus terminal, and his wife, Flossie, asked me to come over, and I took the bus to Rutherford, and he came home about 15 minutes after I got there, having done his medical rounds in Patterson. He had a large practice amongst the poor and working class people of that industrial New Jersey city. And most of his patients, as a matter of fact, were children. For those of you who are interested in some of his responses to this hectic practice, there are these wonderful stories called the Doctor Stories, which have been pulled together, which I'm sure the Concord Bookstore has. He had supper, and I sat with him, and then he wanted to know if I wanted to go out with him and meet some of his patients, and I did. We drove back to Patterson. Not an easy drive then. It was now New Jersey Turnpike. And I saw him at work with children. He's older than I am now, but still able to sit on the floor with them. There are some continuities in this life. He carried in his pockets and those Hershey Kisses, which looked exactly the way they do now, with the same little paper foil, silver foil, and a other piece of paper to open them. He'd feed the children, he'd bargain with them, and he'd treat them. And sometimes he'd get into arguments with their parents. It was from him that I first learned something about the moral life for children in a didactic way. He pointed out to me how concerned the children were about him, how they would often comment on how tired he was, and they worried about him. They told him to take good care of himself, and I was interested in that. And I met one of them who was concerned with him because she was 8 years old, and she remembered that the last time she'd met him, he'd had a bad cold. And she still remembered to ask him about that cold. I was so moved and touched and inspired and turned on, as they'd say these days, by him that I went back and started taking pre-med courses, which was not an easy job for me. And the result is I then went on to medical school and then went into pediatrics, and then while I was doing pediatrics, we had a polio epidemic, one of the last this country would ever see, just as the Salk vaccine was about to come into use in the 50s, late 50s. And there I met children who were paralyzed, many of them in iron lungs, which we certainly don't have these days, had a kind of polio called bulbar polio that affected the brainstem, the breathing center. And there I met children who were ill and had every prospect of continuing to be ill. And while I was trying to take care of them medically, they were quite interested in asking me the questions of a kind that Job asked in the Old Testament. Why did this happen to me, and what did I ever do to deserve this, and what is this life about anyways, that people like me going about our business get sick this way? These questions were profoundly introspective and profoundly moral in nature. Some of them made pacts of sort with fate if they got better, they would live differently. And I would ask them, not in a particularly psychiatric mode, but just out of curiosity in the way one makes conversations with people, I would ask them, how would they live better? And then they would tell me that they would be more concerned and respectful to their parents, to their friends. They wouldn't be as mean-spirited as they knew that they had occasionally been, and on went this recital of moral self-scrutiny in the Augustinian tradition almost. Then I met a few children who had leukemia in the children's hospital, who then were destined for death because we didn't know what we know now, had no chemotherapy. The only thing we had for them was blood. I will never forget some of these children preparing not only themselves to die, but their families, that they would be leaving them. And in their own way, their doctors, some of them knew a lot more about what was happening to them than we gave them credit for knowing, and some of them were a lot better able to take what was happening to them than some of us were. And some of them were profoundly reflective about this life and were able to seize upon its important moments and remember them even as they prepared to leave. I remember talking with one of my pediatric tutors of sorts, an elderly pediatrician who was willing to spend a lot of time with us. And he pointed out to us that sometimes even 1 and 2 year old children have what he called a capacity for empathy. They can hear a child crying and themselves begin crying, or look toward the child with a pained and worried expression. I'm sure many of you know that within your own family lives, what even the youngest pre-verbal children can almost as an aspect of their humanity respond to suffering. Not all children, of course. It is also true, unfortunately, that children even who are 6 months old, a year and a half, can be very cool and aloof and suspicious and even mean-spirited and angry and truculent. Having been mistreated, they know how to be angry, and worse even, to bite, to kick, to refuse any kind of normal, friendly relationship with the world that lasts for any length of time. Now, this is not totally new knowledge to us, the kind of what I was observing. We are living in the 20th century, and in a way it can be said that this century psychologically began in the year 1900, when Sigmund Freud published The Interpretation of Dreams. And now psychoanalysis informs our lives in ways that we often don't even think about, but it has been a major influence, of course, in the 20th century Western world, its insights into the human mind. And then there is child psychoanalysis, which was almost single-handedly begun by Anna Freud, Sigmund Freud's daughter, in the 20s, and by Erik Erikson after her, and Peter Blos and others, Viennese men and women who you might be interested in knowing were originally teachers. Anna Freud was a school teacher, an elementary school teacher, before she began first her analysis with her father and then the whole field of child psychoanalysis. And Erik Erikson was an artist and a school teacher, and so was Peter Blos and August Eichhorn. So there was an intimacy between teachers and psychoanalysis at the very beginning of all this kind of investigative work in Vienna and elsewhere in Europe. And a lot of those people, because of Hitler, came to this country in the 30s to Boston and New York, and were very much a presence in the Massachusetts General Hospital and in the Children's Hospital, as they were in the major hospitals in other cities in this country. When I went into child psychiatry and then psychoanalysis myself, I put in a lot of time with children and was supervised by some of the older European analysts, got to know particularly Eric Erickson and taught in his course when he came to Harvard. And what I began to learn from them is how sensitive children are, not only to family life, to mothers and fathers, to brothers and sisters, and this is surely common knowledge now, but how sensitive they are, of course, to the classroom, the schoolroom, the neighborhood, and very important, of course, to the kids they play with in the streets, and very important, too, to the values of any particular community. Now, let us remember that when psychoanalysis emerged, it was immediately feared as a dangerous kind of ideology. The Anna Freud, I many times heard her comment with a wry, ironic look backward and how angry people got at her and her co-workers for the kind of work they were doing with children. And yet she pointed out, interestingly enough, there are many ways in which psychoanalysis connects with the traditional Judeo-Christian view of children. What did Anna Freud and Eric Erickson notice as they began to work very carefully with children? They began to notice that children who are 3 or 4 are full of all kinds of impulsiveness. They began to notice, by the way, what you noticed, many of you as parents, but that slowly they learn discipline and control, presumably, if they're given half a chance to by their parents, and indeed encouraged to by their parents. And that by the time they get to school, they coined a phrase for it. They are in what they call the latency period. And what do they mean by that? Many of you, all of you, I presume, know what they meant by that. They meant that that a good deal of the emotional energies and tensions, including the sexual energies and tensions, the strong interest in family life, in origins, in how babies are made and whatever, this is slowly but relentlessly put aside as they go to school and take on the tasks of civilization. They had all sorts of words for these so-called defense mechanisms, and I'm not going to get into technical psychoanalysis here, but a lot of these words have become everyday language for people who have no particular training or interest in training in psychoanalysis, repression, suppression, whatever. That a lot is put aside by children, and necessarily so, as the children attend to what? They attend to learning, and they become part of a society in which control is very important. Well-known book that Bruno Bettelheim wrote years ago, Love is Not Enough. You bet. You bet it isn't. In fact, as he goes on to point out, is it love if a child is not taught before even coming to school self-discipline, control, can't be used too often that word, restraint, in the interests of what? In the interests of some kind of harmony in this world. This society does not function when instinct has free rein. We have to put on the brakes, don't we, in our automobiles, and in our talking with one another, and in our behavior, so that what comes to mind is not by any means necessarily given expression. We have to pay attention to what the laws of the world ask of us. We have to learn how to control ourselves. We have to learn how to keep our mouths shut. We have to learn how to have some control over the instincts in our bodies. And indeed, children who lack this soon enough, if they lack them, if they are that much lacking, are going to be in difficulties in school, at home, and ultimately going to be seeing a doctor. This is not very surprising for me to tell you this here tonight, but it is important that that be remembered. Very important. Because for a long while, psychoanalysis was interpreted as the basis for what? Expression. Expression. Express yourself. That's what's healthy. Say what's on your mind. Talk it out. Well, how long are we going to have a society if everyone is expressing himself or herself, saying what is on his or her mind, and giving full rein to anything and everything that comes to mind and to body, I might add. As for the moral life, I would see some more of that on the streets, in the lawns. I went into the Air Force for 2 years. All of us had to do so under the old doctor's draft. I was in charge of a 48-bed psychiatric hospital in Biloxi, Mississippi. And my life changed because one day I saw a mob two or three times larger than all of us in this room now in front of a school building screaming bloody murder because a little girl was being brought there by some federal marshals. This was school desegregation in 1961 in New Orleans, 30 years ago. I could be here all evening telling you about what I got to know, but instead of leaving that military base and coming back here, I stayed there. I got to meet that little girl, Ruby Bridges. You want to see her in Eyes and the Prize. She's in the second segment. In the second segment, she's shown walking into the France school, escorted by federal marshals. I spent a long time getting to meet and know this little girl and marveling at her capacity to go to school all by herself in a totally boycotted school. One child, one school, one teacher. For a whole year, with a mob there in the morning and the afternoon telling her they were going to kill her. And one of the highlights of that experience for me with her was finding out from her school teacher, and then from her herself, how she prayed for people who wanted to kill her. We all found this out because one day when the marshals brought her to school, she stopped in front of this mob. They were always anxious to get her in. The police were not protecting this girl at all. The police were protecting the mob. And the federal judge who ordered her to go into that school, in accordance with the Supreme Court ruling, had to be gotten out of the city himself because of the mob. This little girl one morning stopped in front of the mob, and the school teacher, looking out of the windows of the school, saw her talking. By now, both the school teacher and I are waiting for a psychological collapse in a girl having this kind of education, coming from a poor family. They didn't know how to read or write. They were utterly vulnerable, socially, economically, racially, educationally, you name it. The school teacher was puzzled by the fact that this girl seemed so friendly and so anxious to learn. She ate well and slept well and studied hard. And of course, I've treated lots of kids in Boston before I went in the Air Force who came from well-to-do white families, some of them going even to private schools, and didn't notice that all those advantages prevented them from getting all kinds of psychiatric disorders. Here was a little girl who had no advantages at all, and she seemed to be having trouble getting sick. So we waited, And then we thought we had something because she stopped in front of the mob and they went berserk and the marshals had to draw their guns. And when she came into the schoolroom, the teacher said, "What happened to you today, Ruby?" And she said, "Nothing." And the teacher said, "Well, why'd you stop in front of that crowd and stop talking to them?" Ruby said, "Well, I didn't say anything to them." And the teacher decided, as all too many teachers do decide, not to pursue this any longer. She would defer to higher authority. Possessed of higher authority, I went that evening with my wife. We went to talk to Ruby, as we were doing twice a week. I asked this little girl what had happened that morning, and she said, "Nothing." Well, you know what words like denial mean. It's been part and parcel of getting on these days, using such words. I asked her how she was doing. She said, "Fine." I asked her what had happened that morning, and she said, "Nothing." I said, "Well, Ruby, something happened. The teacher told me that something happened." She said, "Well, nothing happened, really." I said, "Well, what did happen?" She said, "Well, that mob got all upset." So I said, "Why did they get upset?" She said, "Well, I think because I stopped for a while." So I said, "Well, why'd you stop?" So she said, "I stopped to say a prayer." I said, "Why'd you stop to say a prayer?" She said, "Well, because I forgot." I said, "What'd you forget?" She said, "I forgot to say it where I should have." This is a 6-year-old girl. Well, she had an arrangement, I found out, with the federal marshals that she usually said a prayer a couple of blocks before the school. And she'd forgotten, and she saw the mob and saw the school and started praying. In my head, I start thinking about all these defensive maneuvers that are going on in her head. And I'm probing, asking, listening, figuring out. I said, "Well, Ruby, what do you mean you stopped and said a prayer? Couldn't you have waited?" She said, "I could have, but I just thought of it, and I thought I would." So I said, "Well, did you have to say the prayer?" She said, "I like to say prayers." I said, "Are you doing a lot of praying these days?" She said, "A lot." And she told me that she prayed in the morning, and she prayed before while going to school. She prayed while on the way home, and she prayed at night. So I said, "That's a lot of praying you're doing." She repeated that she liked to pray. So I said, "Well, why did you pray right there?" I went back to that scene. So she said, "Well, I saw the people, and I thought I'd say a prayer." So I said, "You did. You thought you'd say a prayer." She said, "Yeah, I said my prayer for them." I said, "You said a prayer for them?" She said, "Oh, yes." I said, "Why would you want to pray for them?" There was a pause. She looked at me. She said, "Well, don't you think they need praying for?" I looked at her. I'm not going to let her get away with this. Time has come for me to push. I said, "Well, Ruby, they may need praying for, but they say all these awful things to you, terrible things, and why would you want to pray for them?" So she said, "Well, I'm the one who hears what they say." Well, that made a little sense, but I thought to myself, how does she really feel? What's going on underneath where all truth resides? So all too many people, I'm afraid, think. So I thought, well, I'll help her to talk more about this. Isn't that what we're supposed to do in this century? Get people to talk more about things. Be better for them, so we say. So I said, "Well, Ruby, it's true. You do hear what they have to say. You're the one who knows them pretty well. But what they say is pretty awful. And I'm still wondering, whether you really feel like praying for them as much as you are praying for them, or whether you don't have some other feelings. And she said, well, I don't like them, but I sure think I ought to pray for them. And then I thought, well, I'll ask her what she says in these prayers. And I did. I said, what do you say in these prayers? And she said, well, I always say the same prayer. And I said, well, what's that prayer? And then she told me what she'd been saying now for months. She said, I just say, please, God, try to forgive those people because they don't know what they're doing. Now, even a secular mind like mine, I stood there in that kitchen and I thought to myself, this has been said before. In the history of the world, this has been said before. And I said, Ruby, why do you say that? And then she explained it to me. Talk about the moral life of children. She said, well, you know, when Jesus had that mob in front of him, that's what he said to God. So I said, well, Ruby, did you get any help in thinking about what you might be saying in this prayer? She said, well, my mummy told me the story of how Jesus lived, and my grandma did. And I'm going to try and do the best I can, and I'm going to try and talk the way he did. That's what she said. If you take a careful medical, psychiatric, or educational history of this family, the mother and father didn't know how to read or write. Couldn't even sign their names. They'd come from the Delta of Mississippi. They'd been in New Orleans only 3 years. And yet, they knew by heart the Galilean sayings of an itinerant rabbi, teacher, healer, preacher. They knew about the prophetic teachers of Israel. They knew who Isaiah was, and Jeremiah and Amos. Knew by heart some of those moments from prophetic Judaism. And educated their daughter in this. You know what my wife said to me when we left that house? We went to a bar in downtown New Orleans, still around, called the Napoleon House. Good drinks and nice music. My wife was sitting opposite me, as I well remember, and she said, tell me, what would you do if you had to go into the Harvard Faculty Club and there was a mob waiting for you every time you went there? Well, I answered back, I sure wouldn't pray for the mob. I'm much too educated and psychoanalyzed to do anything like that. I'd call the cops. Ruby's family didn't even have a telephone, and they certainly didn't have the notion that the police were going to pay any attention to any telephone call that they would put in, even if they had the money to put a telephone into their home. Next thing I would do, my wife and I figured, is after calling the cops, get a lawyer. Well, Ruby's family had no lawyer. Actually, I found out I was the first doctor she'd met. She was delivered by her great aunt. It had been in Mississippi. She'd never had a pediatrician to take care of her. No lawyers for Ruby and her family. The third thing I would do would be to mobilize all the authority of the social sciences and psychology and all those ologies. I talk about the psychosexual this and the sociocultural that. All those hyphenated expressions, they are wonderful. They show how smart we are. Maybe I'd escalate a bit, say these people are sick, they have character disorders. Where you hear us talk a lot about character disorders, what's character? That we don't talk about so much. Character disorders. They're acting out. That's a serious charge. My wife and I spent a whole weekend in the Waldorf Astoria listening to the American Psychoanalytic Association discuss acting out. We left the place and we were walking the streets of Manhattan. And my wife said to me, tell me, I have a question. I've known to gird myself when she asked some of these questions. I said, what? She said, what is the difference between acting out and living? That's what we would call a methodological question. Well, you can even finally call those people crazy, would some psychiatric authority on the streets. Ruby had none of this language. No language of psychology or psychiatry or psychoanalysis or anthropology or the social sciences. And the fourth thing, of course, I would do would be to write an article about what I was going through. Ruby had yet to learn how to write. All she knew how to do was pray for forgiveness to people who told her they wanted to kill her. And I'll tell you, when you meet a child like that, and I've met more than one, you're carried right back to this town of Concord and to the life of Ralph Waldo Emerson and to his American Scholar Address delivered in 1837 at the Harvard Divinity School. And they never invited him back. Because in that address, he made a very important distinction, one I think it's not inappropriate to make right here, right now. The distinction between character and intellect. That all the intellect in the world, all the knowledge in the world, all the charts in the world, all the erudition in the world, is by no means even going to begin to help us to take the long road down that will lead us toward character, goodness of heart and mind. And of course, that brought me also back to my great hero, William Carlos Williams, because in Patterson, he pounds away at this relentlessly. No ideas, he says, but in things, the concreteness of life. And he goes on to remind himself, let alone his readers, that you can be very smart and not necessarily a good person. As Emerson, above all, in American Letters, insisted and set the stage for further insistence on the part of the writers and thinkers who would follow him. Of course, Williams knew Ezra Pound very well. They'd known one another from their early 20s in Philadelphia when Williams was going to medical school and Pound was a graduate student at the University of Pennsylvania. Pound, great poet, brilliantly educated, consumed by hate. And Williams, oh Lord, knew what we've been discovering now in dribbles for 50 years, that it was possible in Nazi Germany for the most brilliant people to be consumed by hate. Philosophers such as Heidegger could embrace that way. Psychoanalysts for a while such as Jung and others. Physicians, lawyers, college professors, teachers of philosophy, biologists, you name them. All that knowledge in no way gave immunity to hate. So moral life is not to be confused with moral analysis, with going through high school, college, graduate school. Joseph Goebbels, one of the top three Nazis, an intimate of Hitler's, had a PhD in comparative literature from the University of Heidelberg. I remember Williams telling me that on the way back from seeing one of his patients. He said, "Don't forget that, young man." So when I walk through Harvard Square, sometimes I think of it, and so do my students. One of them came to see me a couple of years ago, who had gotten two A's and two moral reasoning courses in our well-known core curriculum. He came to talk to me and he said, "You know, I got these A's." He said, "I'm not a very good person." I said, "Oh, come on, being a little hard on yourself, that kind of reflex comes out of mouths like mine perhaps a little too often." The glib psychological reassurance of this age. Well, he went on to tell me about some of the things he'd done. I began to lose my certainty about whether he did or did not deserve this. And finally, he persuaded me that what he really needed is a good swift kick in the pants and more. Brilliant. And a mean-spirited character. It so happened that I knew a young woman who had every bit of knowledge about him. She'd come to Harvard from South Bend, Indiana. But her father did not teach at Notre Dame. She said, "I'm sick and tired of people asking me what my father teaches at Notre Dame." Her father worked in a factory. She was poor. She got a job cleaning up rooms at Harvard. And his room was one of them. She'd go into the room. They never gave her the time of day. They were too busy with themselves. Talking about themselves, bragging about themselves, planning their lives. She said, "It's awfully hard to come into a room and not even be acknowledged with a hello or goodbye." So I said, "Well, you're reading Invisible Man in my course, and there it is. That's what Ellison meant. This isn't only race or class or gender. It's the way we are with one another, unfortunately. All too many of us, even in this big shot place, maybe especially in this big shot place, for it was once said that the last shall be first and the first shall be last, and maybe that's what we're discovering here, even if it isn't written in one of the buildings in this particular institution. Why would they write it?" But in any event, one day one of them paid attention to her. He paid attention to her. He was ready for action, condoms and all. And she got, how do we say it in that clinical world, hysterical. Oh, I suppose there's a part of me that says, in her own way, the hysteria measured some interest in this matter. But every once in a while, I get a little sick and tired of that kind of thinking. And I've been encouraged by people like Anna Freud to get sick and tired of it, too, because I heard her once at a conference at Hampstead say, "It's all very well to understand all these moments, but what matters, what truly matters, is the worth and dignity of a life and how it is lived. Consciously. Never mind the unconscious that we happen to probe. Consciously, this character had been a scoundrel. And she was very upset, and why shouldn't she be? She was ready to quit the university, go back home. I said to her, well, if this place has taught you nothing else, but that someone who is smart, clever, and writes brilliant editorials for a newspaper in the college, expresses all the time his compassion for the South African blacks thousands of miles away, can treat you this way, and you've learned a hell of a lot. She didn't like that. She didn't like that. And I can understand why. What she wanted to look at is how all of us are trained to think solid, healthy, vigorous young man could have passed any course given him here in anything. English, Latin, math, and I might add the psychological test. Healthy sexuality, knew it all. Offered precautions, and was basically a crude, cheap, ignorant person. See all these charts about moral development in children. Boy, do they come with those charts. The ladders marching people up to the highest form of moral development. What do they mean? They mean that some psychologist comes and asks children about moral scenarios and gets answers. They mean that Ruby would definitely be in the lowest rung of that developmental scheme, pre-conventional. Absolutely right. Wouldn't have the slightest idea how to answer some of these moral dilemmas. Didn't know who Immanuel Kant was, how lucky she was. Didn't know who this one or that one is. Only knew how to pray for people and wanted to kill her. She knew some other things too. She once gave me a little lecture at the age of 8 on how Jesus lived. I said, how did he live? She said, well, you know, he was a poor man. He was a poor man. All his friends, they were poor too. They were fishermen and they worked in the land. And he was always worrying about people who were hurting and having troubles. And he took pity on everyone, even the people who were very unpopular. Nevertheless, only pre-conventional. You get some more courses, you get older, you can answer the questions better, no question about it. These strategies for the evaluation of moral development, really are intellectual strategies to figure out the capacity of the intellect to do moral analysis. Not that even that will help you get to the top stage, which is called post-conventional. Don't think anyone just gets in there. Gandhi was put in there, and Dr. King integrated it. The Cambridge theorists who figured this out no doubt include themselves in this. And if they're friendly toward their neighbors, maybe they'll slip some of their neighbors in it. But most people kind of work their way up, but not to the top. And I don't know how high Ruby has ever gotten, in the sense that I can picture someone doing all kinds of tests on her and finding out that maybe if she answered this hypothetical scenario that way, she's not up to par. What she was up to is in her behavior, her conduct, experience. That's where these experts have to pull back, or ought to pull back. It being quite possible for me to come here this evening and give you the fanciest lecture imaginable, full of statements, pronouncements, bring out the blackboard, announce all the theories. Don't even call them theories, call them facts. We tend to do that all too often. Self-promotion is not totally beyond our capacity. To do that and walk out of this high school and be what kind of a human being? Who knows? Who knows? How do we find out? What I'm trying to tell you this evening is that there's a lot more to moral life than espousals, than knowledge. If one of the great moral philosophers of Germany, Heidegger, could hold hands with Hitler and the Nazis for 10 long years, then I ask you, how are we going to save ourselves? We are going to save ourselves in how we behave with one another, and it is a lifelong challenge, isn't it, for each and every one of us? And it is quite possible for children, even elementary school children, to be blessed with a kind of thoughtfulness and moral sensitivity that is remarkable, even as it is possible for plenty of us who are known as teachers or psychologists or psychiatrists or experts to be not very nice people. Not very nice people. This is the kind of irony that a writer such as George Eliot or Tolstoy or Chekhov or Dickens knew all the time. Some of these ironies escape us in the social sciences. So anxious are we to hand down declarations. This is what is true or right or ought be done, or that. Boy, are we sure of ourselves. Very sure, at times all too sure. I will tell you now, speaking simply as a father and a fellow human being, where do children get their moral lives? Don't we all know? From those with whom they live. And they get their moral life not by what's said to them, but how life is lived around them. Don't they? whether we're courteous to one another and thoughtful, or whether we care not very much. And I'll tell you, if a child is lacking in that kind of moral experience, we need Ruby's prayers for that child or those adults, don't we? In the home, mothers and fathers, in the neighborhood, but especially in the home. It being one thing, by the way, to talk a big line, it being another thing to live out a life. In the home. And not through courses, but through the everyday experiences that are utterly either redemptive or all too damning. I spent a couple of days at Phillips Exeter a few years ago, and the vice principal, she taught chemistry, I'll never forget, she said, I can tell about the character of these children. She said, not by testing them, not by asking them all kinds of psychological questions. She said, I just watch how they behave in the chemistry lab. Some of them will come in, she said, and they have knives in their elbows. They're out to get rid of anyone and everyone. Only themselves do they care about. She said, others will come in and they'll see someone in trouble and they'll stop their own work and they'll reach out to help. And I feel like taking that person and driving that person down to you people in Cambridge and say, here's the person to take at Harvard. I don't care what your test scores are. Here's someone with character. Well, we have yet to reach that kind of civilization that we respond to that teacher. But boy, did she know something. We are ultimately as we behave. And how do we learn how to behave honorably and decently? I can't repeat it too often. Through the knowledge we obtain, not from lectures and courses, but out of love, conveying impassioned messages. Here is how we must be, and furthermore, here is how we are in this family, and let us hope and pray in other families too. You're struggling with a matter of sexuality. Let me tell you. Sexuality that lives in a life that does not have moral strength lived out is utterly its own boss. Don't we know that? How do we learn the authority of a moral life, whether it be in connection with sexuality or aggressiveness or all the other forms of instinctive behavior that we're capable of, given permission, given abdication. It's not all that hard. It's not all that hard for children to know control if they have lived a life in which they have been attended to and learned what control means, its pleasures, its possibilities. Without it, we are at the mercy, as Anna Floyd once put it, of the anarchy of drives. It therefore seems to me very important, that in our schools and in our homes, of course, we understand the importance not only of affection for children and courtesy toward children, but their need to join this world, to be part of it, to know how to say no as well as yes, to know how to put aside as well as to embrace. Years of work go into this at home, years of work go into this at school, and it is our responsibility, it seems to me, to stand firm for values. Not values clarification, but values. Values. Rights as against wrongs. The Supreme Court may have taken the Bible out of our public schools, but at no time has the Supreme Court told us that we can't teach our children in the public schools values. And you say, what kind of values can we teach our children that all groups will respect? And I say the answer to that is so easy that it is fascinating how hard this answer seems to be for some people to understand. And you ask, what are those values? I say, is anyone going to oppose values such as considerateness, thoughtfulness, respect for others, courtesy, politeness, an ability to put oneself in the shoes of others, the golden rule, and all kinds of values that are offered us, by the way, by writer after writer after writer. Whether it be George Eliot or Dickens in this high school, I hope and pray, or Mark Twain, or Salinger, or whatever. Values through poems. I remember the fifth grade experience I had, I'll never forget it. A certain teacher named Miss Avery, I've memorialized her in a poem I wrote. She would come into that class and she'd slam the ruler down on her desk. And we were running around and she'd say, sit down, shut up, take out your books. And then if we were lagging behind, she'd say, be human beings. Now, if we hesitated too long, she'd take us into what was called the cloakroom. These days, she'd probably be hauled before a judge for child abuse. But she swatted us when we were obnoxious. And when I went home and told my mother about this, my mother said, thank God. I don't think I was scarred. Quite the contrary, what I began to learn is this teacher really meant business. I remember her crying when she talked to us about Abraham Lincoln. She wanted us to know what this man was like and what his presidency meant. She brought him to life, and she used his life as a means to inform our lives. And then she would read to us from certain poets. I remember her reading a line, and she'd write it on the board, have a heart that never hardens,
a temper that never tries, and a touch that never hurts. And then she'd say, it's awfully hard to live up to that. And she said, as you children know, I don't. But I'd like to try, and I'd like you to try, and I'd like all of us to try. And pretty soon, she had us with her in a morally energetic classroom, using history, literature, personal anecdotes, stories, to awaken us to our moral responsibilities to one another. And here I am, old as can be, it seems, remembering her and never forgetting what that classroom was about. And grateful to her for what that meant, because I carried some of that with me home. And I think we can continue to do this in the schools, even as we must do it in the homes. I remember my mother and father very clearly punishing my brother and me for behavior they felt was wrong, directed at other children, and at times apologizing to the parents of other children. It's hard to do when you're a parent. Hard to do. We have pride. But pride goeth before the fall. And both the Old and the New Testaments remind us about pride. Nowadays we call it narcissism, don't we? The culture of narcissism. Plenty of that around. Plenty of preoccupation with the self. Oh, the self, and more of the self. I feel like this. This is what it means to me. I hear where you're coming from. And all that gobbledygook, psychological gobbledygook. All too uncritically accepted, I regret to say, in the schools. I remember when I was a second year resident being given the title of a mental health consultant to the schools of Newton. My wife, who had been teaching school for a few years, she said, what do you know about schools? I said, I don't know, but that's what they're calling me. And I went over there, and the teachers would come to me frightened out of their minds, shaking virtually, to tell me about this or that problem. And here I was, an idiot of sorts, telling them, well, it's interesting what you're saying. An abdication of our own professional responsibilities. All too many teachers willing to abdicate them. And I regret to say the clergy, who've had an extended love affair with psychology and psychiatry, at times uncritical in its dimension, grabbing on to every possible psychological piety as if it's the Lord's latest announcement from on high. I remember Anna Freud wryly commenting on that. She said, at first they persecuted us in the name of religion, she said, and then they made us another religion, she said, and then all the other religions came to us asking us for answers. She said, this in one lifetime. And that's the way it goes, unfortunately. I urge you to be the mothers and fathers of your children. To be the mothers and fathers of your children. And ultimately, to understand and gloriously accept that responsibility. to have the courage to ask of them as well as to give to them. To set standards for them and try so hard with them to live up to those standards. To try to find a moral life for a family, to hand that on to another generation. The answers to these dilemmas will not be given you in courses in school or college, nor given to them. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was at Union Theological Seminary and went back to Germany to stand up to Hitler, was ultimately killed by Hitler. Dietrich Bonhoeffer did what he did out of the conviction of his heart and out of a life that had already been lived before Hitler even came to power. He, as he once put it, had no choice and was gloriously happy that he had no choice. I remember Reinhold Niebuhr telling us how they wanted to send Bonhoeffer to a psychiatrist in New York because they thought that he had an urge to suffer, a masochistic tendency that was propelling him to go back to Germany when he need not have gone. Such are the moral paradoxes and dilemmas of our life. The answers are not going to come to you from people like me getting up here and giving you a cozy lecture on child development and moral development, which you can then go and find amplified in some course. The answers are going to come through pain and anguish and irony and inconsistency and the paradoxes of this life. The answers are going to come through Tolstoy and George Eliot's Middlemarch, through Anna Karenina and Master and Man and the great human tales. They're going to come out of Isaiah and Jeremiah and the life of Jesus. They're going to come out of Shakespeare and Dickens with that wonderful phrase, telescopic philanthropy, reminding that young woman, because she remembered that phrase, that you can write big shot editorials in the Harvard Crimson. You can parade up and down a street here telling everyone how virtuous you are and what your positions are, and not necessarily in those small and utterly revealing moments in a home or in a neighborhood, not necessarily be the good person, the good Samaritan. There's so much handed down to us through our religious life and spiritual life and the literary gifts offered us by these extraordinary figures. And we can hand on to one another, but ultimately I think it is the message of the heart of a mother and a father with a child that says no as well as yes. I can't say that too often. It teaches a child restraint and the virtues that are important. And let us not forget that there is a time and a place for everything under the sun. Let us not hurry and push our children into intellectualized knowledge that means very little to them, while there is so much that we have to teach them about the ordinary moral knowledge of everyday life, how to get on with one another and be with one another. The schools, at times, have been the victims of one fad after another in this century. And I suppose we'll be world without end, as the phrase goes. But we parents know there is only one life for our children. Let us call upon common sense. Common sense meaning the ordinary knowledge that Ruby's mother and her grandmother had when they turned to her and said, "Oh, Ruby, you have to feel sorry for those people and even pray for them." When I think of how I might have spent my time with Ruby trying to help her to get angry at those people and to express her anger and talk about her anger and work her anger out, then I can only be thankful to the good Lord that I had her mother and her grandmother as teachers. I'll never forget going to England and presenting a lot of this to my colleagues, and Anna Freud, listening to this, she scratched her head and she said, "Another reminder to us how much we have to learn from those people who supposedly have so much to learn from us. I repeat, how much we have to learn from those people who supposedly have so much to learn from us." And on that paradoxical statement, I think I'll end. And I'll be glad to take any questions that any of you have. Yes, I have to shout. I know what you're getting at. Look, the human mind, I once heard one of my colleagues put it this way, the human mind is like Macy's basement. I suppose in Boston you'd have to say like Filene's basement. You'll find anything in the mind. You'll find anything in the mind. There is no sin, no vice, no human possibility that in some way isn't possible for any of us. This is sort of common knowledge. What separates us is not what's possible. It's what we've become, how we behave. It's no great discovery to say that you can find in people evil. And given, this is something that Williams also pointed out to me, I ought to have mentioned it. When Hitler took over in Germany, it was the best educated nation in the world. The lowest illiteracy rate. So much for all this talk about, oh, just educate people. Well, the response to that is, educate them in what way? Educate them in what way? Factuality, cultural literacy. I'm in favor of everyone knowing the state capital of all 50 states. Wonderful. But what about moral literacy? And how do we educate ourselves so that we don't hate? There's a hateful side to us, and given enough pressure, any of us, or most of us, will yield or begin to yield. This, the great moral heroes knew. Bonhoeffer in his diary, St. Augustine, they all knew this. Thomas Merton, Rabbi Heschel, they all knew this. What separates us is some capacities that we build off to fight this and fight it with some success, even against various temptations. And some of us, let's face it, do a better job in our daily lives than others. But of course, the world at large brings out the worst or the better in us, doesn't it? And you get enough of an inflation and enough unemployment, etc., and pretty soon you have a lot of craziness around. As they found out in Germany and in Italy, and as any country, I regret to say, ultimately pushed hard enough can find out. And what we have to do with ourselves, with our children, for one another, is hope and pray that somehow we will be spared that kind of terrible moment that Elie Wiesel has given us in Night, that any number of witnesses, moral witnesses, have given us in this century. But I think the satisfactions of parenthood, and I might add of teaching, the satisfactions are that we learn what it is possible to do to help strengthen one another, and by the way, in doing this, to be strengthened oneself. A lot of attention to teaching a moral life in children, but in so doing, we are teaching ourselves a moral life, and this is part of our moral education, and a very important part. And any kind of sex education that isn't connected to this kind of thinking that I've been talking about here, I can only hope and pray that we will think very carefully about what is this? What does it mean about us? what does this mean about us? I will go and say something now that is utterly leaping into something else, but sometimes as I think about issues such as, for instance, condom distribution, I think to myself, this is very interesting. Most of us as parents know what we want for our children. We know how we want, I hope we know about the virtues we want from them and the control and the moral life that is lived in, for them when they are 10 or 12 or 15 or 18 even. Others give to them. Others. But what does this tell us? Another them. Give them this for us. We hope and pray somehow it'll be different. There are many different kinds of thems. These days, sometimes I think it takes a lot of work on the part of some of us to stand up for some of those virtues I used to hear from Miss Avery, not to mention from my parents. As Christopher Lash told us in The Culture of Narcissism, there's an undercutting of our moral lives from all different directions. Just turn on the television set. Look what we accept now. And accept, and accept. And even the clergymen, I deeply regret to say, are swept up in this. Sometimes with a lack of the most ordinary kind of common sense, I went to a meeting in which narcissism was discussed by my colleagues. They were talking about narcissistic personalities. Well, there was an edge of humor in that room that was hilarious, but it never came to the surface, because what was going on is narcissism was being narcissistically argued about by theorists of narcissism. This is something that Dickens would have just laughed all the way to the next novel over. But there was no humor in that room, no humor directed at us. We have to learn at times to mock ourselves, even to laugh at ourselves, and to find in ourselves what is there for everyone. The narcissistic discussion of narcissism, as my wife would say, a big joke. Who is there teaching us humility? Warning us about the sin of pride, especially those of us who give lectures and come out with our course materials. Who is teaching us a little bit of humor? And maybe even encouraging us to say, you know, there are a lot of things we just don't know, or some of the things we know, but we're even afraid to stand up and say these days. I keep on thinking of Anna Freud because I was so close to her, and I think if she were here, I honestly do, I've heard her under similar circumstances, I think she would just shake her head. And I don't think she would call for prayer, unfortunately. But maybe a little more of this, and even she might have called for prayer. I honestly, I'm telling you the truth of my heart, I don't understand this. I don't understand it. And I would go further. I don't approve of it.